So welcome to this launch event where ODI and the Center for Climate Change and Development, CCCD, will present their research on Nigeria's fuel subsidy reform, its impacts on different groups, as well as the challenges of process and outcomes that have affected the sustainability of reform. So as many of you will know, in May 2023, Nigeria removed its petrol fuel subsidy amidst very high levels of political consensus that it was incurring unsustainable and inequitable costs. But in 2020, 2022, sorry, the government spent the equivalent of $9.7 billion on fuel subsidy payments. So petroleum pump prices increased more than 200% overnight after the subsidy removal, leading to high welfare losses, particularly for low-income and rural households. So the OECD, the ODI and CCCD report released today fills the need for some empirical analysis on the subsidy reform by providing rigorous and evidence-based analysis of the controversies around Nigeria's fuel subsidy removal, which have been well reported in the press, but we'll have an opportunity to dig a little bit deeper today. So we'll give four brief presentations of the research findings. ODI conducted a desk review and key informant interviews to understand the elite level political settlement in Nigeria's fuel sector and did political economy analysis on that and identified what opportunities there were for socially inclusive reallocation of fiscal savings for subsidy reform. And CCCD will present the findings related to the distributional effects of fossil energy subsidy reform across different income groups. And so in doing so, they'll help us understand, the potential remedies and opportunities to design and implement fossil energy subsidy reform. So welcome, everybody. Many of you will be joining from different parts of the world, including Nigeria specifically. As you join, you'll be able to pick up on the conversation, those who've had issues joining immediately. So we'll have a 90-minute event. We'll begin with an introduction where we'll hear from Professor Chuks Okereke on the importance of getting fuel subsidy removal right for climate resilient development. This is very much our starting point in undertaking this joint piece of work. And then we'll hear from Dr. Nick Simpson on the key messages from ODI side, from our ODI working paper. And then we'll hear again from the Nigerian colleagues. So we'll hear from Dr. Chukwuemeka Emenike on the distributional impacts of fossil fuel subsidy reform in Nigeria, based on empirical work that they've conducted over the last year. And then we'll hear from ODI's own Dr. Chandel Stedman, who'll present 10 recommendations for policymakers on how, what to avoid, and what to do to undertake sustainable fuel subsidy reform. And then finally, we're delighted to be able to have two interventions with reflections on the findings that would have been listened to and the current state of fuel subsidy reform in Nigeria from the Honourable Solomon Marin and Honourable Sam Onigbo. And they'll get us a picture from the policy-making class within Nigeria, which will be fantastic. So without further ado, let me hand over to my esteemed colleague, Professor Chuks Okereke, who is also from CCCD. And he will take us through the importance of getting fuel subsidy removal right for climate resilient development. So let me just say a few words while he's prepping. So as I said, He's with CCCD. He is the director. The CCCD stands for the Center for Climate Change and Development. It's at the Alex Ekwemer Federal University. And he's also a visiting professor at the Universities of Reading, the London School of Economics, and the UK. So Professor Okereke was previously the co-director of the Centre for Climate Justice and also the Reading University Leverhulme doctoral scholarship program. He's had a number of other posts over the last 20 years, and his work has led to high-profile national and international projects on climate change policy, green economy transition in Africa, including in Nigeria. I don't want to delay further, but just to finish by saying that Prof has also been the coordinating lead author of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC Sixth Assessment Report. So without further ado, over to you, Prof, to walk us through why we need to remove full fuel subsidies for climate transition reasons. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Catherine, and thank you very much, participants. Let me start by saying how, as the director of the Center for Climate Change and Development at Alex Ekwemer Federal University in Nigeria, how excited I am to have collaborated with the famous and prestigious Overseas Development Institute to undertake these analyses on the welfare effects of the subsidy removal in Nigeria, with clear policy recommendations on what we could do to make sure that we are on the right path. Now, the impacts of climate change is being felt around the world. Nigeria actually is one of the most vulnerable countries to climate change, with sea level rises, extreme weather events, drought, which is also impacting on food security, flooding, which has become a recurring national disaster with a huge number of lives lost. And so it is important that Nigeria makes its own contribution to addressing climate change. Now, we know that the major source of emissions, or greenhouse gas emissions, is from the consumption of fossil fuel. Now, for a very long time, and this is not just the case of Nigeria, countries around the world have been subsidizing fossil fuel production and consumption, sometimes up to $100 billion per annum. In Nigeria, subsidy has been in place since the 70s. And some analysis have suggested that Nigeria in the last 18 years have spent up to 22.7 trillion on subsidy, petrol fuel subsidy. Now, it came to a point recently, as Catherine indicated in her opening remarks, where everybody felt that this has become a bit albatross, a wedge to against economic development and bearing down on Nigeria's ability to function as a nation fiscally. And so the removal by President Ahmed Bola Tinubu last year was broadly welcome. However, several years of experiences from around the world have indicated that whilst it is important to really address fuel subsidy, it is also necessary to do that in a way that is consistent with the broader objective of sustainable development and equity and justice. In other words, to ensure that while we are trying to tackle the issue of climate change, we do not do so in a way that actually increases poverty, increases distributional inequity or unfairness, either within or across countries. And so it is important to get the fossil fuel removal right not just for climate purposes, but also for social, economic, justice, development purposes. And so that's why across the world, governments pay attention to very careful attention to various ways in which a subsidy can be reformed, removed, recalibrated in order to ensure that the worst are the least people, are the least economically advantageous people in any country are not further burdened with economic injustice as a result of fighting climate change. And so everybody say, most people say actually in Nigeria that this is a policy that is long overdue. But there hasn't been any detailed analysis to really find out the welfare effects of the subsidy removal in Nigeria, especially on Nigerian households. And that is a task we have undertaken with ODI. So we've analyzed the welfare impact of the subsidy reform on a Nigerian household, looking at their household energy consumption patterns, their budget, their home prices, the behavior, but also looking at the effectiveness of the government redistributive policies, the so-called palliatives, and trying to understand the impact on varied income groups across the country, and coming up with some concrete recommendations on how we think the government can make the policy a bit more progressive. And so we welcome your engagement with the presentations that was going to be made. We very much value your input in making this research. We use economic modeling tools, but also we engaged extensively with thought leaders in the various sectors in Nigeria, including people in the government, in the private sector, and the non-governmental organization agencies. So I will yield to my colleagues who will get a bit into more detail about what we did and the results that we arrived at and the recommendations that we suggest that Nigeria should take in order to make the subsidy reform a bit more progressive. Thank you very much. And again, welcome to this webinar.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Prof. And in my rush to get us started, I didn't even introduce myself. So my name is Catherine Nwajakudahu, and I'm the Director of the Politics and Governance Programme at ODI. I was also delighted to have been involved in at different moments in this joint piece of work, which I'm glad that we'll all have a chance to listen into. I just want to just underscore what Prof just said about the questions that we've been trying to tackle, and not just about the importance of fuel subsidy removal, but how to get it right, not just for climate reasons, but for social and economic justice reasons. And I'm hoping we'll have some rich exchanges about what that actually means, what it looks like and could look like in Nigeria. So thank you very much, Prof, for setting us off. I'd like to now hand over to my colleague, Dr. Nick Simpson, who's going to give us an overview of his assessment of the subsidy reform in Nigeria. So Nick is a senior research fellow, recently joined ODI in the climate and sustainability team. His research focuses on how we can best respond to climate change. He has a special interest in climate resilient development pathways for Africa. He's working on the Just Energy Transitions partnerships that many of you may have heard of, and the intersections of climate change with education, heritage and migration research, all themes in ODI of quite a lot of importance. So Nick is also an IPCC author. He's an affiliate of the African Academy of Sciences and has been nominated to the UNF Triple C roster of experts. He has a PhD in society, environment, and sustainability from the University of Cape Town, and he sits on many advisory boards, and is a member of the World Adaptation Science Programme Working Group on Loss and Damage. So I'd like to invite you, Nick, to give us your assessment of Nigeria's petroleum subsidy removal and reform.
And yeah, just to say, this is the joint assessment drawn out of quite a synthetic piece of work integrating the modeling work that Professor Chooks just described that CCC partnered with us on, as well as work that's done significant research, policy analysis, key informant interview processes, and workshops to really try get to the nub of assessment of Nigeria's petrol fuel subsidy. So, fossil fuel subsidies in Nigeria and worldwide are a drain on public finances, widen fiscal deficits, contribute to climate change, air pollution, and congestion, discourage the adoption of cleaner renewable energies, disproportionately benefit those who consume more fuel, and reduce the money available for investment in other areas. Yet, fuel subsidies are notoriously difficult to reform. And as we heard, previous attempts in Nigeria have led to public backlash and eventual reinstatement of the subsidy. In this instance, petrol pump prices increased more than 200% in some areas overnight. At a global scale, the benefit of subsidy removal is particularly clearly shown when comparing finance needs for renewable and fossil fuel subsidies. While energy investments over the next decade to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, as per the Paris Agreement, are estimated at $2.4 trillion per year, the International Monetary Fund estimated fossil fuel subsidies in 2017 alone totaled $5.2 trillion, or 6.5% of the global GDP. Fossil fuel removal, therefore, holds potential to contribute substantively to climate resilient development through releasing finance for low carbon and sustainable development imperatives. Yet, subsidy removal can have adverse distributional impacts, especially on the economically most vulnerable groups, which in some cases can be mitigated by measures such as redistributing savings. Yet subsidy reform could allow Nigeria to begin planning for a transition away from fossil fuel dependency. It should be noted that merely saving money that would otherwise be allocated to the fuel subsidy is not in itself sufficient to ensure that these funds are equitably allocated. Indeed, there are a whole host of further governance challenges to be addressed. And so, our first big takeaway from the report is that it highlights fuel subsidy removal is a function of multiple political, economic, environmental, and social interactions that need to be managed in concert and at multiple levels with an eye to context. It notes that failure to recognize and integrate these dynamic factors in the policy process could undermine the success of subsidy removal and its associated potential climate and development gains. Despite being socially regressive and environmentally harmful, subsidy removal has proved extremely politically challenging. Fossil fuels play a fundamental role in Nigeria's political economy and have enriched a substantial political economic elite through both licit and illicit means. At the same time, fuel subsidies are generally supported by ordinary citizens who view them as one of few consistent benefits delivered by the Nigerian government. So, subsidy removal has been fiercely opposed by many camps because cheap fuel is widely considered to be the right of Nigerian citizens of an oil-producing country. At the elite level, the opacity of the subsidy regime and of the fossil fuel sector as a whole provides significant opportunities for rent seeking and illicit enrichment, which disincentivize political and economic elites from pursuing progressive reforms in the sector. Fossil fuel reserves provide a substantial source of political and economic power. So pathways to successful reform, therefore, also need to navigate countermeasures by entrenched interests, corruption, lack of transparency regarding the oil and gas related earnings and perceived benefits of the subsidy for low income groups. Successful subsidy reform therefore relies on public acceptance in the government's commitment and ability to deliver on social protection and compensation measures to redistribute and repurpose the savings of the subsidy. Trust in the government is linked to people's perception that the government is willing and able to implement reforms. As a result, efforts to overcome trust deficits are a key enabler of successful subsidy reform as they increase confidence in the government. The Nigerian government has currently fallen short of building this kind of public support, credibility, and confidence as it relates to the fuel subsidy. A paced and sequential approach would have allowed the government to engage in dialogue with groups that would have been impacted by the subsidy removal, including labor unions, manufacturers associations, student unions, and women's organizations, who could have provided insights into the impacts of the reform. The analysis also finds that there was little to no consideration of assessment of the impacts of reform beforehand. The findings show that welfare effects have been felt unequally across Nigeria, which we will hear more of in the following presentation. Particularly, increases in petrol prices following subsidy removal have disproportionately affected lower income households. While it is too early to offer any definitive judgment on the long-term success or failure of social protection or compensation and the reallocation of savings from subsidy reform, analysis of current actions finds that compensation measures were not adequately put in place before the subsidy was removed. There was an ad hoc and poorly coordinated series of compensation measures, which were widely felt to have been insufficient. The negative impacts have been experienced by key population groups, suggest that the subsidy reform in Nigeria lacks governance principles of distributional justice that would at a minimum include safeguards for the poor and most vulnerable and compensate those experiencing the greatest impacts. Given Nigeria's political economy, and depending on how the government implements the reform, there's currently no guarantee that it will advance those transition outcomes with equity and justice. So to conclude, fuel subsidy reform, if accompanied by high-level political commitment to ensuring its success and productive reallocation of savings, can potentially stimulate other low carbon and sustainable development benefits that can shift development pathways towards greater climate resilience. But to do so, the government needs to build public acceptance and trust in the process, build in better impact assessment and compensation measures. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Nick, for that very clear presentation about what your assessment, what our assessment is of the fuel subsidy removal process in Nigeria. You highlight the absence of effective communication and trust building and advise a much more staggered and paced approach in which gaining and building public acceptance is central. You also highlight the important negative impacts that have been felt by the poorest, the lowest income categories, and the opacity of the political economy surrounding fossil fuels in general, and the use of the subsidy as really important barriers around which we need to concentrate our minds. So it's great that we have members of the House to speak with us, and I'd be very intrigued to hear what their take is on your conclusions. So without further ado, let me pass the floor on to Dr. Chukwuemeka Emenekwe, who will walk us through the welfare effects of fuel subsidy reform induced price changes on households. This detailed empirical analysis that was conducted. A few words about Dr. Emenekwe. So he is a senior, he's an academic staff member of the Department of Economics and Development Studies and a senior research fellow at CCCD. At Alex Ekwueme Federal University, he in Ebonyi State, Nigeria. So he has conducted research on topics including economic assessment of deep decarbonization pathways, fossil fuel subsidies, and just energy transition, as well as green industrialization. He's also worked on a number of very high profile national projects on climate change policy and green economy transition in Nigeria as co-principal investigator. Done a lot of work using modeling techniques to explore long-term strategies in Nigeria, work funded by the French Development Agency. And he has done very interesting work on weather index reference valuing maize and soybeans in Oyo State, funded by the French Embassy in Nigeria as well. Interesting. He has a diverse portfolio under his belt. So let's hand over to you, Dr. Chukwuemeka Emenekwe, to walk us through some of the household level effects.
Thank you very much, Kathleen, and thank you very much to all the participants. In this section of our collaborative effort, we aim to understand the distributional and welfare consequences of progressive fossil fuel subsidy reform, which are critical to the sustainability of reform as well as progress towards more just and inclusive energy transitions. This section of the work has four key objectives, specific objectives. The first one is to describe the household energy consumption patterns of Nigerian households. And then secondly, we'll estimate the elasticity of demand for these energy consumption goods, just so I clarify. Elasticity of demand simply measures the degree of responsiveness of demand to changes in some economic factor. It could be income, it could be price. All right. And then we use the elasticity estimates to explore some simulation analysis of the welfare impact across Nigerian households. And then we'll look into the redistribution policy, which is what the government has actually stated that it will use to cushion some of these effects. So we'll look at these effects across targeted redistribution policies across more households in Nigeria. All right, so our analytical approach employs microeconomic theories and microdata to explain consumer energy demand and elasticities. An important aspect of this analytical approach is that we use, it offers us the opportunity to use a large number of observations, and it also helps us to control for household characteristics for Nigerian households. Now, the source of our data is the Nigerian Household Survey, which is a product of the, which is conducted, to be precise, by the National Bureau of Statistics in partnership with the World Bank's Living Standards Measurement Survey. So we use the most recent three surveys. So the first one is in 2010, 2011. The second one is in 2012, 2013. Third one was in 2015, 16. And then the most recent is in 2018, 2019. So we concentrate on the most recent three. And then our analytical approach also allows us to do a two-step budgeting process where household total expenditure is classified between energy and non-energy goods. And then in the second stage, we focus squarely on the energy expenditure, where we decompose it further into petrol, as well as kerosene, electricity, transport, and then a broad category, which we call others, which takes into account the rest of household energy expenditure. But please allow me to indicate that a key characteristic feature of the most recent survey is that it doesn't decompose between public transportation and private household transportation expenditure. So we had to lump it up. However, this is not the focus of analysis. Our focus is on petrol. All right. So the first objective, which is to describe the household consumption patterns, focusing squarely on petrol. What we find out is that petrol is a significant energy expenditure item for Nigerian households. So for the overall sample, we have a value of about 20,968, which works out to roughly $88. But we urge caution in interpreting this because one of our observations of these summary statistics is that there's high variability. So we have a standard deviation of about 49, and then a minimum value of zero for households who didn't purchase at the time of the survey. And then some households will purchase as high as 2 million. So that's why we urge caution with interpreting this. But the key takeaway from this slide is that petrol accounts for a significant share of household energy expenditure, which is roughly 18%. If you look at this the left chart below here, so petrol itself accounts for about 18%, and then electricity is roughly 13%, kerosene roughly 15%, and then transport, like I said, is lumped together. So that's what obviously gives you this high number. But the key takeaway is that petrol price increase could have a non-trivial effect on Nigerian household when the price increase, especially upwards. Next slide, please. Next slide. All right, thank you. All right, so our estimation of budget analysis, precisely income elasticity of demand for petrol, shows that petrol could be classified as a normal good. In economic speak, what a normal good is a good or an item whose demand increases with income, right? And then we also found that the budget elasticity for petrol, if you look here, the value of 0.748, it's less than one, less than unity. What how we interpret this is that for the average Nigerian household, petrol is a necessity, right? And then the results are consistent. If we look at the subsamples of our household, when we divide by income, low income, middle income, high income, as well as residential location of the household. So we have urban and rural households. So our estimates of this income elasticity of demand for petrol is consistent across subsamples. And then when you look at other household energy items like electricity, transport, we also see that they could be classified as normal goods, because their elasticity values are less than one. But these estimates are different for kerosene and the broad category that we call others. The only exception here is under low-income household income elasticity for kerosene, where it is a necessity, not a luxury item. All right, next slide, please. Next slide. Okay, now the second aspect of the elasticity analysis on demand is the on and across price elasticity of demand. Now, our results or findings are consistent with consumer demand theory, where there's an inverse relationship between the price of a specific good and the quantity demanded of that good. So what we see here is, in absolute terms, the value of the on price elasticity for petrol is less than one. So it shows that petrol demand is price inelastic. In other words, for the average Nigerian household, an average Nigerian household shows an inelastic response to petrol price changes. So if you look at this value here, so the first point is that for each of these energy items, we have a negative values, which suggest the negative relationship between the price and the quantity demanded of any good. But the value that is less than one shows you that for a 1% increase in the price of petrol in this case, there is a less than 1% decline in the quantity demanded. So it suggests that even with price increase, there's still going to be demand. But what it does is that it strains the household budget, right? And then on the right side, we look at the cross price elasticities, right? So we have positive cross price elasticity, but our interpretation of the result is that with this positive cross price elasticity, as petrol becomes more expensive, there is a tendency for households to increase their consumption of other energy commodities. What this means is that they try to search for substitutes to petrol, driven by the need to maintain energy consumption levels with coping, with the price rises in petrol. However, we know that due to the small magnitude, the small size of the values of these elasticities, this suggests that these alternatives are not perfect substitutes for petrol at a household level. Next slide, please. All right, and then we take our elasticity estimates to simulate the welfare impact of a 100% increase in the price of fuel. Our previous panelists already indicated in some places you had our values of fuel prices increasing as much as 200% and all that. So in our study, given at the time we started analysis, we projected 100%. But of course, every percentage or 100% increase reflects the magnitude of the change. So we think that 100% pricing offers a broad audience the ability to understand what the analysis is about. So our welfare measure in this study is what you call in welfare economics, we call that the compensating variation. So what this compensating variation means is it measures the total monetary transfer that is required to compensate a consumer, that is, to bring the consumer back to the original utility or level of satisfaction after the price changes. But then we measure these as a percentage of their initial total expenditure. In simple speak, for a relative comparison, a higher value of the compensating variation implies higher welfare loss. So the key takeaways here is that rural households are relatively more vulnerable than urban households in analysis. Now, petrol price increases are regressive. What that means is that for the poorest household, they are worst affected. Now, we also observe, if you look at the table below, we observe significant welfare losses across board. However, we find that rural and lowest income households are the worst affected. Now, we also know that although high income households will spend more on fuel in total expenditure, this pattern, that's the results that we find, suggests that as the proportion of household energy budget, lower income households are relatively more vulnerable to fuel price increases. What we also note in this study that the analysis is conducted at the cluster level, that is the rural urban, thus smoothing out real world variation among urban households. Next slide, please. All right, so a key aspect of our study that we didn't delve into is the gender disaggregated analysis of the effects or welfare effects of fossil subsidy reforms. However, our study referred to existing empirical analysis, to draw some key insights for our work. All right, so our work square largely refers to the study by Ramirez in 2021. So what they find in gender disaggregated analysis of the welfare impacts of fossil subsidy reform is that female-headed households are disproportionately affected by energy reforms. And this is consistent both in the urban and in the rural areas. Now, this suggests that female-headed households face greater vulnerability to economic shocks, such as subsidy removal. All right. Now, this same study reveals that female-headed households in urban areas experience more significant welfare losses compared to their male counterparts. And then this is also this pattern is also consistent in rural areas also. Now, what this suggests is that policy interventions need to be sensitive to the gender disaggregated or gender-specific dimensions of energy reforms. And then acknowledging the disproportionate effects of energy reforms on female-headed households compels a reevaluation of policy frameworks to ensure they are inclusive and equitable. Next slide. All right. The government of Nigeria has indicated that revenue recycling or redistribution is one of the key policies that is introduced into cushion the adverse effect of the welfare losses that are created as a result of this, right? Now, in our analysis, we look at targeted lump sum transfers to key distribution of households on the income ladder. Now, we identified three key household classifications. First is the bottom 40%. Now, recent data from the UNDP shows that the bottom 40% of the Nigerian population earns only 9.5% of income. So what this means in simple speak is that the bottom 40 represent the poorest households, the worthy representation of the poorest households in Nigeria. And we also explore the official poverty lines. So we have the upper bound poverty line, and then we have the lower bound poverty line. So Nigeria's lower bound poverty line is about 124,900 naira in dollars. That's roughly $347 US dollars. And then the upper poverty line is roughly 137,000, which works out to roughly $382. All right, so we looked at lump sum transfers to these poor household groupings. What we find is that targeted lump sum transfers are progressive. What does that mean? It means that we observe welfare gains in the lower income quintiles when this revenue saved from the subsidy removal is redistributed to these household categories. Now, the magnitude of these gains is highest for the lowest income quintile, which gradually decreases as income increases. Now, the takeaway here is that targeted financial aid to low-income groups ensures a fairer economic reform impact, protecting the most vulnerable in the population. Next slide. All right, so here we put together our key messages that emanate from our analysis. So first, on the impact of the petrol price changes. So our study finds that the increase in petrol prices following subsidy removal is regressive. So what that means is it disproportionately affects low-income households. On the disparate welfare impacts, so we find that there is a significant variation in welfare impacts across different household income quintiles and locations, with rural low-income households experiencing the highest welfare losses. On the redistribution policies, so our analysis demonstrated that targeted lump sum transfers, particularly to the bottom 40, and also the different the two official poverty lines that we've considered, effectively counteract some of the welfare losses, which indicates the progressive nature of these policies. On the policy implications, so our findings suggest the necessity of carefully designed redistribution policies to mitigate the adverse effects of subsidy reforms, which ensures that lower income rural households are adequately supported. And then on the part that we hope future studies will propagate or take further is that female-headed households face greater vulnerability to economic shocks such as subsidy removal. This calls for gender analysis in all stages of energy policy planning and implementation to ensure the unique needs of female-headed households are considered and addressed. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you for making your very technical econometric work understandable to lay people like myself. So it was brilliant. Thank you very much. I mean, we're hearing from
thank
what you
Catherine.
Said, you were hearing from what you said that there were, the impacts were felt most unsurprisingly on the lowest income group households, but particularly you highlighted the differences between rural and urban, but also the female-headed household problematic that needs to be up front and center in the minds of policymakers seeking to get it right. You also suggested that targeted lump sum transfers would also be something that will definitely could definitely have some serious palliative effects. I mean, I think the question for Nigeria is, and we'll hear about that soon, have the palliatives really stepped up to the mark on this? But thank you so much. That was a very, very interesting presentation. So I'd like to hand over now to look more closely at these recommendations for policymakers. And our colleague, Dr. Chandel Stedman, will be doing this. Chandel is a senior research officer with ODI in the Climate and Sustainability Programme. She's doing work on energy transitions. She's also the lead author of the paper, the working paper, that's the joint paper by ODI and CCCD that's out today. Prior to coming to ODI, she worked as a research fellow at Cranfield University, where she conducted research with the UK Collaboratorium for Research on Infrastructure and Cities, on governance and business models for sustainable infrastructure and urban systems. Her research experience and interests also covers consumer decision making and engagement in energy markets, fuel poverty, very relevant here, and the energy transition and transition to modern energy cooking services. She has a PhD in economics from Loughborough University. And I, without further ado, I want now to hand over the floor to you, Chandel, Dr. Chandel Stedman. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Catherine, and thank you everyone for being here. Firstly, just thank you also to the previous my colleagues who just finished their previous presentation, which highlighted the overview of the results from our ODI assessment of the fuel subsidy and also the distributional impacts of the subsidy. So my presentation will just nicely wrap up some of the key takeaways and key recommendations that could be drawn from these studies for policymakers on sustainable and successful fuel subsidy reform. And while this is a bit Nigeria specific, a lot of these recommendations could also be lessons learned that could be adapted for more globally for other countries who are undertaking fuel subsidy reform. So we would have just heard in the previous presentation that the Nigerian fuel subsidy reform did have distributional impacts, and some groups were more disproportionately affected compared to others. So I guess one overarching recommendation I just want to highlight based on that is just the importance of government when reforming fuel subsidies of undertaking these kinds of studies, just to ensure that they understand who will be impacted by the policy and how they will be impacted, so that they could design social compensation measures for these people who are disproportionately affected. So that leads me to my first set of recommendations. Based on these findings, we of course recommend for these lower income households who are experiencing these negative impacts, there should be targeted lump sum transfers to these groups, so to counteract some of these negative welfare impacts. Then for the women-led households, it's also important to provide targeted financial assistance, strengthen social safety nets designed to specifically support these groups. And finally, like the savings from the fuel subsidy reform could be targeted into targeted programs for urban and rural low-income households who are also experiencing these negative effects. And these could be through things like investing in more efficient and affordable public transport systems, because this could counteract some of the negative impacts of the higher petrol subsidies on urban low-income households. Next slide, please. So the second set of recommendations have to do with the design of these social compensation measures, because it's really important to make sure that they are well designed so that we could get these, be able to sufficiently mitigate these negative impacts. So for example, in Nigeria, successful implementation of the National Social Safety Net Program scale-up is crucial because, of course, it provides cash transfers to millions of households who need it most. People, it could help them get out of poverty, it could help increase support for the subsidy reform, and of course, like counteract some of these negative welfare impacts. But to really ensure that there is transparent transfer of these funds, there are some issues with transparency and social register issues that need to be addressed. We had a workshop a couple of months ago on this project, and a lot of the attendees, there was a discussion about the fact that the social register was incomplete, and there was, of course, need for more data collections that we could be sure that the people who need these transfers and these palliative measures the most, they could be adequately reached and targeted. So that leads me to the next recommendation about that assistance programs need to be based on more comprehensive data collection. So whether this is data collection on household expenditure, household income, other socioeconomic indicators, there's a need for just more comprehensive data collection just to ensure that the people who are experiencing these negative impacts, they are reached, they are identified, and they are properly targeted. The third has to do with the intra-urban disparities, because we heard about how there are impacts on urban low-income households, but also rural low-income households. So these policies, there should be policies that recognize these intra-urban disparities while also remaining sensitive to the unique challenges facing both the rural and the urban low-income households. Next slide. So we heard a lot through the initial presentation about the fact that building public trust and building government trust confidence in the government is key to just increasing support for the subsidy reform. So a few recommendations around this. Firstly, it's important that the government engages in dialogue with the groups who are impacted by the subsidy removal. Ideally, this should have happened before the subsidy was reformed, but either way, it's still very crucial to the subsidy's success. So this would involve engaging with groups like labor unions, manufacturers associations, students unions, women's associations, different stakeholder groups who would really be impacted, because this could help the government to gain insight into who is being impacted, how are they being impacted, how best we could mitigate these negative impacts that they are experiencing. So engaging with these different groups will also build trust in the government, because of course people would be able to see like, okay, maybe our voices are actually being heard and considered. The next recommendation is around gender inclusive policy design and increasing women's participation in decision making. So this again goes back to the point about the fact that women-led households sometimes experience more distributional impacts of energy policies. So if there is this gender inclusive policy design, if women are included more in decision making, then we'll be able to ensure that their unique voices and their experiences are being heard, and that energy policies will be shaped more equitably and effectively. And the last point is around increasing communication with citizens. So this again could It should ideally start before the subsidy is removed, where there could be active communication campaigns just detailing to citizens, firstly, why the subsidy is being removed, the importance of subsidy reform, educating them on this, but also being transparent around the process of the subsidy reform and how the government plans to put plans in place to mitigate any negative impacts that would be experienced. So increasing communication is really important for transparency and increasing just public buy-in and support for the subsidy reform. Next slide. Thank you. And the last point is, in the longer term, it's important that the government has plans in place for reallocating the funds to public infrastructure, education, healthcare, jobs, and to also introduce further reforms to the energy sector, particularly reforms to stimulate renewable energy industries, because these actions could help to meet the socioeconomic development of the country and also meet climate commitments. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chandel. I mean, I think you did a brilliant job in pulling together and deepening some of the reflections that emerged in the previous presentation, and focusing on the questions of design of policies, the need for more data, and the need for very explicit inclusion of women and citizens in order to build public trust. Question I think we also have to address ourselves to is if the savings, or maybe I just put it on the table, if the savings emerging from subsidy removal are targeted to addressing some of the pressures on household, low-income households in particular, what questions of the trade-off and proportionality, how much will there be reallocated to investing in stimulating renewable energies, which is really one of the other ultimate ambitions of the subsidy reform. Okay, I think we're doing very well. We've been going for almost an hour, so I hope everybody is still raring to go to listen to some more. We have two excellent speakers coming up now, so I'd like to pass over to Honourable Sam Onigbo, who is vice president, as well as being a member of the House of Reps, and vice president of Africa Global Legislators Organization for a Balanced Environment, that's GLOBE, and senior advisor on climate. He is a senior advisor and sponsor of and father of the Nigeria's Climate Change Act of 2021. Which you must all, he may say a bit more about. So we know that the act led to the establishment of the National Council on Climate Change, and Honourable Onigbo represented Ikuanu Umuahia North and Umuahia South Federal Constituency of the House of Representatives between 2015 and 2023. He became elected as the board of Global Legislators for the Balanced Environment GLOBE International, and as Vice President for Africa, first Nigerian to be recognized as such. He was President of GLOBE Nigeria from 2019 to 2023 after serving as Vice President there. So he is Chairman of the Climate Parliament in Nigeria from 2020-23 and is currently, this is important, he's currently a member for the Southeast Governing Board and Chairman of the Committee on Security, Climate Change, and Special Interventions of the Northeast Development Commission. So he's got a lot on his plate. So we're delighted that he has had taken the time to come and speak with us today. Over to you, Honourable Sam Onigbo. Thank you. If you could just unmute yourself.
Yeah, I'm okay.
Great,
I think you can hear
great.
me now.
Yes, we can.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, good afternoon, everyone. I'll be very brief. I told Professor Chumerije, actually, I'm on my way to the eastern part of the country. I was almost going to leave. But I really want to say that the issue we are discussing is affecting us directly. Some of the contributors or speakers either speaking from either London or somewhere, we are here, we are feeling it, and we're seeing exactly how we are progressing with the policy. There's no doubt that that was a fundamental issue to be handled, something that had actually been tried many times in different forms, but it was never concluded. So in a way, President Ahmed Bola Tinubu, GCFR, deserves some commendation for being able to do what we've been trying to do over the years. Yes, there is a problem. There's a challenge in that it has impacted a lot of people, you know, negatively, particularly the people in the lowest rung of the ladder. But having said that, I was at the time Commissioner for Finance in Abia State. And I know that from the money that we used to get from the Federation Accounts Allocation Committee, after the removal of fuel subsidy, it has increased significantly. So the issue now is how those who are entrusted with responsibility of governing or, you know, applying these resources, whether they are going to be transparent, judicious, and well-focused in what they want to do. That's one aspect. In terms of whether there's been an increase, yes, there's been an increase in the income or the amount that is now available for distribution. So from all you have said, it is a question of working with data and being able to identify the vulnerable households, because they are the ones that are most affected. The people up there can afford to cope with these, with increase in fuel price. However, the issue of transition, you know, is also part of the reason why Mr. President took some of these decisions that he has taken. Let me also say that along the same lines of transition, you know, the president was able to sign the Electricity Act just about 10 days after he assumed office. He signed that in June. And in there are several provisions, both on renewable energy and other aspects. In fact, one key factor of that Electricity Act is that we were able to get it done after we were able to amend the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. We amended that constitution during the Ninth Assembly, which I served in, to be able to remove electricity and associated issues from the exclusive list to the concurrent list. So with that, issue of electricity now and all the things that are associated, like I talked about, renewable energy, they are now in such a way that it is not only the federal government can get involved, you have the state government, you have the local government and all that. Now, all these are geared towards handling the issues of oil and gas, transition, removal of subsidy. How do we put them together to be able to still take care of people, even when far-reaching policies have been undertaken? So for now, I remember that when we were in COP28, one of the fundamental decisions was on how to do this transition in a manner that we move away from fossil fuel. And it was as if I knew that was going to happen because I had published an article earlier where I talked about the resolve by Africans to be able to do this and do it in time, given the fact that we have the resources to help us, you know, do this transition. But now our conversation for today is all about, you know, removal of subsidy and its impact on Nigeria. We can bring all this together, handle them step by step, and move on. Before I conclude, I would like to say that, one, the government is working extra hard now to ensure that maybe the little gaps that were not filled before the subsidy was removed, that they are being tackled. Just yesterday, the CBN was able to give over 100 billion. I do not know how much that comes to in dollars to the Minister of Agriculture to really contribute in reducing the impact, negative impact of the removal of subsidy. That was just yesterday. So that's, and in addition to that, there are other areas that Mr. President has decided to take strategic decisions in terms of deploying resources. because I'm talking about the impact now and how we can ameliorate, you know, all the problems that the removal of subsidy has caused. So while I have listened to the efforts, the impact to vulnerable communities, the ordinary people, families or households that are headed by women and all that, I think that I would like to say that in all, and for me, this is a road that we all know that we're going to travel through. Because as far back as COP26 at the Scottish Parliament, when I made a presentation, we said we would like to use gas as a transition bridge as we are going towards this round. Now, we are in it, and we have to bear it. And I don't have any doubt that as a nation, and given the policies of the government, that we will all go gradually towards it. And then take into consideration some of the suggestions that have been put across on how we can do this. Do not forget that as a deliberate policy, and also in our act, the Climate Change Act, we provided that we're going to do transition. The issue of hitting net zero, I remember our president talked about 2060, but the act actually specifies that we're going to do this between 2050 and 2060. So beginning now is a good way to go. Removal of subsidy is painful, but the government is doing all it can right now to be able to, you know, really take care of the people who have been so badly impacted. So I want to thank all those who have made presentations today and to say that even the NNPC in Nigeria, working with a company like Total Energies, they too are making sure that as we are going on in this transition, we also create something like, you know, what is solar power and things like that, so that the cost of fuel, the cost of kerosene, all those things that we have mentioned, if you can have solar energy in your household and all that, then you probably don't feel these things as much as we are feeling them today. So it is really a policy issue that the government has taken, and we're not going to move back on it. Instead, we must continue to work as a people from the federal to the state to local government and even by the private sector, ensuring that we are able to put the nation on the right footing for future development.
Thank you for your time. Thank you very much, sir. I'd like to thank you for your time and giving us your on the ground insights into what's actually happening and what the government under President Tinubu is invested in moving forward. I think it was really helpful that you acknowledged the findings of the research, notably the impacts on the lowest income households, and where I think it's useful to note the efforts that you announced, notably with the Central Bank of Nigeria's allocation recently of 100 billion naira to the Ministry of Agriculture. I think as we'll move on, we'll continue to engage, you know, to explore how some of the recommendations that my colleagues outlined can also accompany your reflections as to the ways forward on this very thorny question. But thank you very, very much. I'd like now to invite our other esteemed colleague and guest, Honorable Solomon Malen, to provide his reflections on the fuel subsidy removal. Just a few words about Honorable Solomon Malen. He's a distinguished professional and lawmaker, currently serving as the National Coordinator of the African Parliamentary Network on Climate Action, a role that reflects his dedication to collaborate and foster collaboration amongst African parliamentarians for effective climate action and sustainable development. He's had a great career spanning parliamentary leadership, engineering, and public service, and played a great pivotal role in shaping environmental policies infrastructure development and legislative initiatives in Nigeria and in Africa more broadly. He's been a strong advocate for renewable energy, amending laws to promote exploration of eco-friendly energy sources, perhaps some of the ones referred to by our last speaker. He served two consecutive terms as member of the National House of Reps, representatives from 2015 to 23, when during his tenure, he was a key figure in developing legislative frameworks on the environment and agriculture and road safety. He's having served as a member of the House Committee on Environment, he also contributed substantially to formulating policies around climate change and sustainable development. Finally, a last word, in November, he became member of the Global Renewable Congress. Okay, without further ado, let me hand over to you, Honourable Solomon Marin. Thank you.
Let me thank you so much for the opportunity. And it's a very wonderful time for me to be here and listen to the erudite scholars who have made several presentations. And we are glad that ODI and other non-governmental organizations are taking interest in the issues of removal of subsidy in Nigeria, the impacts and the way forward. I think this is very, very commendable, and we associate with you. Despite our very tight schedules, we have to sit back to listen to wait and listen to your presentations. Like my colleague has said, subsidy removal, subsidy in Nigeria with removal has been like a time bomb waiting to explode, because our country has gone through several borrowings when they were still being subsidy for petroleum products. And we reach a point where lenders will not be able to borrow, lend money to Nigeria anymore because of the huge debts of borrowing that has taken place, and looking at the resources available and then what we have to commit to subsidizing petroleum products, it became also a very serious challenge. And so the economy was running down. The financial stage was becoming unsustainable. And then, of course, because of our porous borders and the rest of them, so was encouraging a lot of corruption, smuggling was taking place, and so many other challenges. And above it all, the climate change challenge, which will continue to encourage the greenhouse gas emissions in our country. Whereas our country in COP26 committed to net zero by 2060. And then you are still encouraging the burning of fossil fuel. That became an issue that contradicts completely the country's commitments in the NDC vis-a-vis the policy in place. And so let me thank our president, President Bola Tinubu. When he came in, he took the bull by the horn and immediately announced the removal of subsidy. Many leaders wanted to do so because it was not politically correct for them, and they felt that they needed the votes of the people, and that is going to do more hardship on the people, and that would make people not vote for them. But this man did not mind the consequences, the political consequences, you know, of that policy, because Nigeria was at the brink of collapse. And so this policy came to be. Let me thank our scholars for identifying actually some of the problems, you know, that came before the subsidy removal and also after the subsidy removal. And the majority of people who have been affected as a result of this subsidy removal. Yes, agreed, there was no proper and detailed consultation that took place before it was removed. That also took many people unawares, and people could not prepare to accept it. So, and now we have excess of people coming into the states and the federal government, the states, and also the local governments. The issue now will be how well can those resources be utilized for the development of the country? Because it is only when the country is developed that all the issues that those who are suffering the policy from the policy will now begin to know that yes, this policy, although it was very hard on us, at least now we are getting some relief from it. You see, most of our people who live in rural areas, men, they was hit as a result of one, they still use some of these fossil like kerosene as a cooking gas. And by the removal, these costs have gone. And so the only way we can now intervene in this is by introducing some level of clean cooking in the within these rural communities. They can have some clean stock cooking that will reduce those. They can have some solar energy stoves that can also take the position of those. And then we look at also that in the rural communities, goods have to travel from industrial areas to the cities up to the rural community. Transportation cost is also very high. And this cost is transferable. Every businessman transfers this cost directly on the goods he buys. That is why you find out that rural communities suffer this most than any other person. But like my colleague said, in the 9th Assembly, we're able to remove the issue of railway and of course the issue of electricity from the exclusiveness. This were deliberate because if we now have a system that we have today, that states have available funds, local governments have available funds, they should be able to design their transport system within their various areas to be able to cater for their population. And some of these transportation policies may reduce the number of vehicles on average. Because if you are using a communal bus, for example, that carries up to about 50 to 70 passengers, that would mean smaller cars would be like about 7 or 8 smaller cars to be able to carry the same number of passengers. So this is helping. But the area that we, some of us have as climate champions, the area that is challenging for us is that some of these buses that have been bought today should have been electric buses rather than same fossil fuel buses that most of the state governments are still procuring. And so it's a serious challenge for us. We felt it is time for us to begin to look inward and say, okay, let us move away from this fossil fuel completely. It is the cost of the rising cost of goods in our society, the rising cost of transportation itself. If we move away from it and introduce solar panels on some of these buses to be charging some of these batteries used as the vehicles move, it's going to help us. Because here in Africa, in Nigeria, we have a lot of sunlight. And so these are solutions that we are looking at. If these solutions are created by the Nigeria Automotive Council, it's going to go along and help. So we are pushing through the parliament, even outside the parliament, pushing our colleagues to ensure that such policies come to bear. Because without such policies, it's going to be difficult for the rural communities and the poor to be able to continue to afford some of these buses. One quick win that we have also gotten from this is that a very clear example that most people cite examples of the what the governor of Abia State has done in Aba. Today, Aba has enjoyed electricity, I think, consecutively, I was told, in the last 2 or 3 months without a blackout. And so that means that the resources he has gotten, he has put to use. In fact, some of my colleagues came with some foreign partners who wanted to set up a chemical factory. And we're asking them, where are you looking at? They said, no, they're going to Aba because there is power there. You see, so these are some things that instead of Nigeria continuously depending on imports, that if we have these resources and these resources are properly put to use, like Governor Abia has done, it's going to go a long way in industrializing the country, and some of these prices and effect of dollar imported goods will also reduce. And that is also going to raise the economy to a level that our people will enjoy. So we're also looking forward to see, having removed the issue of railways also from the concurrent list, to see how many states are going to also involve in ensuring that they build railway lines across the breadth and the length of their states so that it will ease transportation and reduce the number of vehicles. And let me say that a visual observation of our roads in Nigeria before and after the first of, you can say without carrying out any research that at least are off the road at the moment. And that is, they are off the road at the moment. And that will tell you that, yes, some certain level of a greenhouse gas emission has also been reduced. So I think we are going in the right direction. For some of us, we continue to encourage Mr. President to continue to push on this policy while looking at other things that will help ameliorate the suffering that people are going through. Cash transfer to family has also become a problem because of some level of corruption. We had last a few months ago, a minister was removed as a result of some indiscrepancies that were found in such cash transfers. And as a member of parliament and member of public accounts committee, we did investigate it during the head assembly. And we discovered that there were a lot of money that were not going right to people, reaching the people downtrodden there exactly. Because we took an example of a small town of Kwanga in Sarawak, and we collected the list of people they said were beneficiaries. And out of about 200 and something, over 200, only three people confirmed that they actually. So the rest, either the telephone numbers were not wrong, or and then some rejected and said and denied the fact that they have never received them. So these are some of the problems associated with some of these cash transfers. So we believe that if policies that will be an all-encompassing policy, policy that will affect the entire community, policy that will have a distributory effect on the entire community, would have been better than individual cash transfer. Look at some of this cash transfer they're talking about. How much is it? Less than $0.1 is what you are giving, or $10 is what you are giving to an individual. What can that man do for them? Nothing. But if they have a way in which they can enjoy some level of facilities or infrastructure that is put in place by government, everybody will have a chance to enjoy it. So I want to thank you very much for your time, and
yes,
thank you very much for being part
of it. I want to thank you. Great, thank you. We were able to, we very much appreciate you staying on the line and giving us your assessment. The line was breaking up a little bit, so we might not be able to hear everything. I want to try, we've got a few minutes left, I want to try and gradually bring us to a conclusion. I mean, I'm just hearing from you that you highlighted, like your predecessor, a number of very interesting developments that are actually shifting some practices. So on the electricity front, we heard about the example of the Abia State governor who's taking advantage of the constitutional revisions and so on. So there's a lot that can be done. I think there were some, you were questioning the workability of cash transfers given transparency questions and wondering whether a community-based approach would be better, but I think these are all worthy considerations that evidence-based research will help us kind of work through. I want to just hand over the floor to my colleague Nick. He seems to have a question before we close. Go over to you, Nick.
Thank you, Catherine. Just before we close, I'm not sure if Michael Avenzo is on the call. He intended to be here representing the Nigeria National Council on Climate Change and representing the Energy Transition Directorate. But I see, unfortunately, he's had some connectivity issues and has dropped off. If he's here, I'd like to give him a chance to give a brief 2-minute intervention, but otherwise just to say he intended to be here and thank you for that intention.
Thank you very much. It's a shame we weren't able to hear from him, but as you say, it was good that he wanted to intervene and we can follow up. I also noted that Elizabeth Tanis is online and I think had wanted to make an intervention. Am I, is this correct? Could you please unmute, Elizabeth?
Hi, no, nothing for me. I'm actually recovering from illness, but I just wanted to be here as a means of support, but thank you for the offer.
Well, Liz, okay, thank you. Sorry, it's come up strangely on my chat. I hadn't realized it was you. Sorry that you've been ill. Okay, I think we have said our piece. We've heard from a number of different voices. It remains for me to thank everyone for having participated so actively, to all my colleagues who've really done the heavy lifting in terms of producing the report that's out today, that's the backdrop to this webinar. You'll see the links, the downloadable link on the screen there. So, you know, I want to thank the speakers from CCCD and ODI for sharing those findings and for the interesting reflections of those on the coalface of policy engagement, Honourable Sam Onigbo and Honourable Solomon Marin, for your reflections. You know, it's clear that past conditions have placed reliance on oil. Past conditions, you know, we've needed to make some very hard choices. And I think the boldness that both representatives highlighted is well noted. But we do need to work towards improving the impacts, the negative impacts that these choices have had on sections of the population, in particular those low income categories. So if sustained, and from all what we've been hearing, this will be sustained, early action to ensure that, you know, we're creating the trust, the right conditions, the transparency to really ensure that the savings are invested in ways that not just mitigate the negative effects, but then enable a green and transition-based development is kind of critical. As Africa's largest economy, a country highly vulnerable to climate change and also one of the largest emitters greenhouse gases in Africa, you know, Nigeria has a great role, a very important role to play in delivering on the Paris Agreement. You know, removing the fuel subsidy is a bold and essential first step in this direction. However, confronting some of the vast political, economic, and technical challenges that Nigerians only know only too well to ensuring that subsidy reform is sustained and that the benefits actually reach across Nigerian society is really going to be really important to be seen to and to deliver on. So addressing these obstacles over the next few years will be key tests of the success or failure of the present administration and all those international actors working towards supporting Nigeria's socioeconomic development. So please eagerly download those reports, and we'd really like to continue this conversation with you. So feedback further on what we produced would be welcome, so that we can all work together to sustain the progress made so far and deepen it. So thank you everyone for taking part, and happy reading.
Thank you, Catherine, for excellent facilitation. Please follow the link to download the reports, and we welcome your feedback. Thank you, everyone.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
Yes, thanks, everyone. Bye.